Welcome back to the second hour of It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Coplin. It's time for this week's in-depth interview with a special guest from the arts. And now, here's your host for It's a Question of Balance, Ruth Coplin.
Welcome back. And if you just joined us or you're new to the show, I wanted to let you know this is a two-hour show in which we try to explore whether we have more in common than divides us and balance the intellectual with the creative. In the first hour of the show, we ask questions that matter, avoiding politics. Instead, we focus on issues that underlie politics and current events, issues that affect everyone, locally and globally. And in this, the second hour, we feature in-depth interviews with local, national and international guests from the arts. And the show combines a debate topic with an arts interview because I feel discussion and creativity are two of the most vital ways we engage with the world. It's all a question of balance. If you'd like to find out more information about the show, you can go to our website, itsaquestionofbalance.com. There's podcasts of all past shows there, and you can also connect with me on social media should you wish. So again, that's itsaquestionofbalance.com. Well, this week as my special guest, I'm pleased to be interviewing Caitlin Doughty, New York Times best-selling author of Smoke Gets in Your Eyes and Other Lessons from the Crematory. Born and raised in Hawaii, Caitlin attended the University of Chicago, from which she graduated with a degree in medieval history. Stalked by the idea of death from an early age due to a childhood trauma, Caitlin moved to California after graduating with the intent of entering the funeral industry. She has worked as a funeral arranger and a body van transport driver and attended Cypress College for her second degree in mortuary science. Currently, she works as a licensed funeral director mortician in Los Angeles and owns her own alternative funeral home, Undertaking LA, to help people help themselves handle a corpse. She founded the Order of the Good Death in 2011 with the goal of bringing the realistic discussion of death back into popular culture. Caitlin has a web series entitled Ask the Mortician, and she's been featured on NPR and the BBC, as well as in Huffington Post, Vice, the LA Times, Jezebel.com, Forbes, Bust Magazine, and Salon. She frequently gives talks on the history of death culture, rituals, and the funeral industry, presenting for groups as diverse as the Center for Inquiry, South by Southwest, Dan Savage's Live Lovecast, Upright Citizens Brigade, and the Ontario Coroners Association. Caitlin's unique memoir, which is in turn affecting, shocking, revealing, poignant, witty, inspiring, and always honest, has just been released in paperback. Welcome to the show, Caitlin.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks so much for making the time to talk to us. And I mentioned in my introduction that death really became part of your life due to a childhood trauma. I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about that experience, because it seemed like that is really what has put you on this path that's led to you writing Smoke Gets in Your Eyes.
Sure. I always like to jump right into childhood trauma if possible. just really, you know, breaks down barriers and whatnot. Sets the mood. It's hard to always to say that something happens in a straight line. You know, you have one thing in childhood and it sets everything in motion. That's kind of a convenient narrative. But in this case, I think that there is a lot of truth to that, in the sense that when I was about 8 or 9 years old, I was at my local mall, and I saw a girl fall to what I presume was her death. And it really set in motion to me events of genuine fear of death. And I developed obsessive compulsive symptoms, and I was always terrified that my mother was going to die, or that I was going to die, or that my dog was going to die. And I had to try and constantly bargain with the universe to prevent death. And as I got older, I wasn't as blatantly afraid of death anymore. But I do think that a lot of the work that I do now to get people to accept death and to face death and to interact with it comes from a place of wanting to protect that 8-year-old girl and have her live in a culture that's safer for those feelings.
Well, you say in the book that you and your parents never talked about the incident again after it happened. And, you know, in some ways that seems an amazing response, but I was thinking that perhaps it's part of the whole denial of death culture we live in. Would you say?
Oh, absolutely. And they were wonderful parents. But, and I think that now they, well, I've talked to them about it since then, because of course they've read the book. And I think that they certainly, and I do believe this, they didn't know how upset I was, and they didn't necessarily connect all of the behaviors that I developed to a fear of death. And I think kids are really good at hiding how terrified they are of the world. And a lot of behaviors that children have, acting out and doing negative things, are because of this immense fear and lack of control that they feel. And, you know, my parents grew up in a denial culture. My dad was in Vietnam. He was drafted into Vietnam. And I don't think that when he came home, he was allowed to talk about a lot of that. And so I think it just kind of perpetuates itself in a society. And that's being proven by everyone around us not being particularly comfortable about talking about it either.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And you wonder in the book how your life would have been if you'd been introduced to death differently, saying maybe death could have been your friend. Yet we hide the death of loved pets, even from children, let alone the demise of humans. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on how to deal with death with children.
Well, my cat died about a year ago. She had a mammary cancer, feline mammary cancer, which is sort of similar to breast cancer in cats. And what happened was I was able to have her put to sleep in our home. She was surrounded by people she loved and purring, and I would say that she almost didn't really even know what was going on. And then we had a wake for her at home for a day or two, and then we took her to have her buried. And it was a really beautiful, beautiful experience. And made me, at the end of the process, at the end of the two-day process, I wasn't like, great, my cat's dead. But there was a feeling of feeling better about it, and feeling like I had done right by her, and seeing that transition, and knowing she was really dead and gone. And it's easy to do that with a child. And in many ways, children are much more accepting of that kind of interaction than adults are, after you've been programmed for many years to know that you're afraid of it. And really, when kids come to my events, they ask questions that are far more visceral and intense and about the body than adults do. So kids are really ready to have the conversation in many cases, and really ready to ask the tough questions. But if adults shut them down, you lose an opportunity to make a child feel like those questions are okay.
Yes, yeah, that you saying that makes me think, when I was working as a counsellor for the charity The Place to Be, I counselled a 7-year-old whose aunt had been horribly murdered by her uncle. Mm. And even though the aunt had been like a mother to the little girl, she was prevented from going to the aunt's funeral by well-meaning relatives who thought it would be too sad. And yet she was haunted by not being allowed to be there at the end of her beloved aunt's life, and she felt she had let her aunt down, and she wanted to face her death. So I'm wondering, do you think perhaps, as you say, before we're indoctrinated by our culture, we do have an innate, more natural relationship with death?
Yeah, oh, absolutely, yeah. And in that case, when somebody like a child who's very aware, who's certainly old enough to be aware, and had a close relationship with this woman, her aunt, she really should have been allowed to dictate her relationship to the funeral and her relationship to the death, because she's the most vulnerable person in that situation, really, because she's young and she's fragile, and she should have been allowed to almost create the program that she wanted around the death. If she wanted to go to the funeral, she could have gone to the funeral. If she wanted to sit with the body for a little while, she should have been allowed to sit with the body, as long as it wasn't too you know, nothing too horrific happened to it. She should have been allowed to dictate that, I think.
I mean, what do you think it is that we're scared of in these situations? You know, when we're scared for people, you know, like that, oh, you know, she shouldn't be at the funeral. I mean, it's part of all this smoke and mirrors thing, is it, that I think you talk about in your book a lot, of trying to almost think that death doesn't exist.
Yeah, and it's a lot of it has been set up as almost a dance between the funeral industry and the public. And I don't like to blame one or the other, because it really is, it's just psychology that has been created, and a program that's been created over time, where the funeral industry comes and takes the body away right away and takes it behind closed doors and behind the scenes, and then fixes it up and presents it back to you, almost like a stage show. Mm. And the public comes and says, oh, you're right, the dead body is dangerous. I shouldn't be behind the scenes. I don't know what I'm doing. Death is scary. Death is for professionals. And they enable each other, both of these groups, when in reality, death is not dangerous. It's not catching. You're not going to get a disease from a dead body. You're not going to get a disease from a mental disease from being around a dead body. It's only being around death and being more comfortable interacting with death can only bring increased peace and comfort with the realities of death.
Mm. It seems like people also have a fear of the actual body or some sort of issue with that. I know you were talking about your lovely ceremony and everything you had for your cat. I had a Rhodesian Ridgeback, which when he died, you know, I laid him out and had flowers all around him, and it was a few days. I had him laid out in a cold room before I could bury him, and I got permission to bury him in my garden. And it was really odd, I thought, well, to me, that, you know, my friends thought I was really odd. They thought it was really macabre that I had, you know, mm-hmm. laid out my dog like this. And I don't know what it is. I mean, it's just, do you think people just feel we have to just dispose of the evidence of death? And I don't know. It's a strange reaction.
They do. Yeah, they do now. It's a very modern, very, very modern idea, and still foreign to most other places in the world. Our specific attitude of direct disposal of the dead body. And when your friends say that about your dog, you just, I mean, and it's hard to give other people this confidence, but I would just thumb my nose up at them and say, listen, this is my grieving process. It's so, you know, in some cultures, I just got back from Indonesia, where they often keep the dead body in their home, in their bedrooms where they sleep for two years.
Until
the funeral happens. And there's nothing unusual about that at all.
Right.
And the idea that someone would have their beloved dog in the house for 2 days is somehow like, oh, she's, you know, like hanging out with a corpse
yeah.
in her home. You know, oh, come on. No, it's awake. What are you talking about? It's awake. It's interesting. I did a video with BuzzFeed recently.
Uh-huh.
And it was a fairly entry-level description of what I do and involving people more with the body. And I talked about having the body in the home for a day or two after somebody dies. And some of the comments were just, this woman needs psychiatric help. This woman wants to play dress up with her grandma. And things just like, has we really come so far that basic wakes need psychiatric help, or basic wakes are playing dress up with a dead body?
Yeah.
Like, wow. You know, it's amazing how quickly culture and the cultural message around something can change.
Yeah. And that actually makes me think, I did a topic in the first hour of my show recently, which was, are we medicalizing normal? And it seems to me there's an aspect of that even going on with death, you know, that there's various experiences and ways of being that we have that are now considered a medical issue or problem, and it's almost like that's what's happening with death as well.
Absolutely. Well, in the DSM, I think recently they moved the definition of, if you're grieving more than a week or 2 weeks, it's considered pathological.
Oh my goodness!
It was some ridiculously low number. That, you know, grief is a long unspooling process that can take, especially if it was your husband or if it was your child, it can take months, it can take years to move through a healthy grieving process on that. And then to have some book say, well, if you're still in a bad place after 2 weeks, you need some real help. You know, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
And rightly so, there was outrage surrounding that. But it is medicalization of something that has been happening for tens of thousands of years of human history.
Yeah. Well, if you just joined us, I'm talking to my special guest this week, New York Times best-selling author of the book Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, Caitlin Doughty. We're going to go to a break now, but we'll be back after these messages.
Like the music from It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland? Have you ever wondered what the full songs sound like? Now you can find out by listening to the new EP, It's a Question of Balance Music, available from iTunes, Amazon, and itsaquestionofbalance.com. It's a Question of Balance Music. Download individual tracks or the whole EP from iTunes, Amazon, or itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Hi, I'm Casey, and I'm the second generation owner of Bookshop Santa Cruz. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore and have been located in the heart of downtown Santa Cruz for over 47 years. We feature an extensive selection of new and used books, children's books and toys, gifts, cards, magazines, and games. Our knowledgeable booksellers can help you find just the right book or gift. We hope you can join us for our author events each week, featuring best-selling authors and books of local interest. And if you can't get downtown, our website has over 3.2 million titles, which ship directly to your home. We even have experts on site to help you publish your own book or family history. Come visit us downtown or at our website, bookshopsantacruz.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copeland, and my special guest this week, New York Times bestselling author of Smoke Gets in Your Eyes and Other Lessons from the Crematory, Caitlin Doughty. And we heard from Bookshop Santa Cruz in the break there, and I wanted to let you know that Caitlin is going to be appearing at Bookshop Santa Cruz on the 30th of September at 7 p.m. to talk about her book and answer questions and sign books. So hopefully you'll be able to go along to that. So that's at Bookshop Santa Cruz, 30th of September at 7 p.m. And also, if you want more information about Caitlin and everything that she does, you can go to the website orderofthegooddeath.com. That's orderofthegooddeath.com. In your book, Smoke in Your Eyes, Caitlin, you relate how in the 1800s, thousands of Parisians would line up each day to view the bodies of the unidentified dead as a spectacle. I'm wondering, do you think we are as fascinated by death today, but perhaps more covertly?
Yes, I do. I think that there's no way around being fascinated by death. And as you said, the Parisians would have lines around the block, and it would become a spectacle, and people would sell them fruits and souvenirs outside while they waited to come in and just catch a glimpse of the unidentified death, dead. And I think that we have the same sort of relationship in the sense that we watch crime shows and we watch horror movies and we watch endless hours of coverage of plane crashes. Mm. Or we're fascinated by by the macabre. We're fascinated by death. And it plays on our emotions. It plays on our own fears about death. And there's no way around it. And having, I guess that's part of what I do, is that saying that having a healthy conversation around it is a better tactic than just living it and not examining it.
Mm. Your book is very honest about funereal practices. You say in a prefatory author's note, "For those who do not wish to read realistic depictions of death and dead bodies, you have stumbled on the wrong book." And I was thinking that it speaks to our sort of suppressed horror of death, that you felt you almost had to put a warning at the beginning of the book, like one might for explicit sex or violence, sort of letting people know what they might be getting themselves into. So I'm wondering, what made you want to be so honest and give so much practical detail about how bodies are dealt with?
Oh, yeah. I think people read a lot more really gratuitous, or not gratuitous in some cases, sex and violence than they do anything about what actually happens to a real dead body after death. So I think for many people, descriptions of what's actually happening during a cremation or actually happening when someone prepares or sets the features on the face of a body is probably going to be more disturbing and shocking than, a really intense, violent scene.
Yes.
So I wanted to just say that, to say that there are a lot of books about kind of warm and fuzzy stories from the funeral industry.
Mm.
And I wanted to make sure just that people knew what they were getting into. And if anything, for all the right people, hopefully that would intrigue them more.
Yes.
And they would say, like, oh, yes, and carry on. And the reason that I did it is because, just working in the industry for years, I've really found that the more honest you are, the more that people feel better about death and the more that people appreciate you as a practitioner. So if somebody comes in to my funeral home, for instance, and they say, well, do they just cremate everyone together? How does cremation work?
Mm.
I find, rather than saying, cremation is a high heat process that does reduce the body to, inorganic material, I find that saying exactly step by step what happens, if that's what they want, usually gets people pretty fascinated, and they want more, and they want a direct explanation of the process. And at the end, they say, okay, that's not as bad as I thought, because people's imaginations are so much worse than anything that's reality, for the most part, with death.
Yeah.
So once you explain to them what's going on and what you're going to be doing, and they know that their mother is going to be in good hands and she's going to be well labeled and this is how the process is going to go, they no longer feel as bad about handing over mother to some unknown back room somewhere.
Mm.
And that's what I want them to feel. I want them to feel like they can have any questions they want and that nothing will be hidden from them.
Mm. I mean, it is one of the sort of ultimate lack of control processes or incidents in one's life. I mean, it's bad enough if you have an operation or something, you don't really know what people could do to you. But, in this instance, like you say, you're giving up someone you love and you have no idea if, they're going to treat that body, well, or whether they'll be talking about the football game, while they're doing it, or, it's sort of terrible to have someone you love just that out of your control, isn't it?
Right, which is why, and some people, to be honest, some people will be talking about the funeral or talking about the football game or talking about what they did the night before, or because it's a job for funeral directors, and there are funeral directors who really, really care about their job, but you can't go into work every day and say, this is Martha. She died. Let's reflect on her story.
Yeah.
You don't know this person. You don't have that emotional connection. And to try and develop that emotional connection every day is very difficult. And that's why my big encouragement is to have families be much more involved with the care of their own dead body.
Right.
Because who really does care about Martha? Her family.
Yeah.
Her family really cares about Martha, and her corpse is meaningful to them. Her corpse is a shell of someone who was very important to them, and just doing little things, even just being there and knowing that she's being taken care of and knowing that you can have some part in taking care of her as kind of a final act, I think really, really does something to help the grieving process.
Yeah, absolutely. And you talk about in your book how it used to be common in the fairly recent past to lay the dead out in their homes, even in America, which seems much more intimate and caring. When did we stop thinking that that was the way to do things?
It really stopped around the same time that medicalization of dying happened, the same time that people came in and took away death in the form of creating slaughterhouses and taking death away from the individual, killing their own meat. Mm. So it was really a time in the early 1900s, 1920s, 1930s, where almost all of our death was being taken away from us. And this was the rise of the funeral parlor as well, and the rise of the quote-unquote professionals, who are the embalmers, who are the ones who specifically have to do things to treat the body and make it safe and make it, make it okay for you to be around it. Whereas before that, it was totally fine to be around your own dead body. Maybe you'd have someone come in and you'd pay him a little to lay out the body, or you just do it yourself. And it became a thing that was for professionals, as with many other industries as well.
Right. One of the most disturbing aspects, I haven't finished the book yet, so there may be something more disturbing later on, but
I'm sure there will be.
One of the most disturbing aspects of the book that I've read so far is the revelation of the embalming process, which is much more invasive than I think most people would think. And I wonder, when did we start embalming people in America and why?
Well, embalming really as the modern iteration of it really started during the American Civil War. And it was a time where all these soldiers from the North were going down to the South to fight in battles, and the families wanted them back because it was really important for the family. And what's interesting and ironic is that the reason that embalming started is that families wanted to be close to the body. They wanted the body back intact. They wanted it to come back up north. And there wasn't enough time to get them back up north without bodies starting to decompose. So there were embalmers that set up tents on the battlefields and followed battle to battle and started embalming the bodies and chemically preserving them, and then sending them back up north, which in a way is still a valid service. If you're trying to get a body from Los Angeles to Berlin and you want to have a big viewing when it gets there, it can still be a good idea to embalm, because it really slows down, and there's no refrigeration, so it really slows down the decomposition process. Mm. But what it's become is that it's done almost as a matter of course in a lot of funeral homes, as opposed to a special situation thing. Mm. And so many, it's never illegal not to embalm a body. You never have to embalm a body, but the way that a lot of funeral homes I think don't even really know that this is that they're doing this, or they think they're doing the right thing, they will basically tell the family, and of course, we'll have him embalmed, and it's almost not even a question, and that's an extra $900 on the bill, but it's not even a question whether or not it will happen. And most people haven't interacted with death enough, or don't know the facts about embalming, so they just assume that if the professional is telling them this is a process that has to be done, that they have to do it. And so nobody calls them out on it, and it's just, again, the cycle between the public and the funeral industry continues.
Yeah. I mean, part of what disturbed me was this, I forgot, is it called a trocar or something? The instrument that they insert, and they kind of basically, it sounds like, sort of chop up all the insides and then suck out all the liquid. I when I was reading that, I was thinking, oh God, people who've had their, family member embalmed or whatever are going to be reading this thinking, oh my God, is that what happened to them? Because I think most people don't realize that. But at the same time, I was thinking, even though this is awful, and in some senses you think, well, it's better that people don't really know the details. If you have those details, you do then have an informed choice about what you want to do. Is that part of it?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. That's the point. And I have to say that the book came out about exactly a year ago, and in all the touring I've done and all the reviews that I've tried not to read but do sometimes, and all of this time, I've probably had one or two people say, and this wasn't these weren't actual family members, these were people in the industry who have said, you were hurting people by releasing these details. You're hurting families. They're going to have a horrible, you know, they're going to have horrible nightmares about what was done because you revealed what the process was.
Mm, yeah.
And so those two people versus quite literally thousands of people who have said, this makes me feel better to know this.
Yes.
It makes me feel better to know, even if some of this was a really tough read and a really intense read for me, I feel more informed, I feel more empowered, and I feel like I can make decisions that are better for me going forward.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think there's a part in the book where the embalmer, you have a conversation with the embalmer where he basically says, you know, that he, can you imagine doing this to your own mother or whatever? And you sort of question, if he wouldn't do it to his mother, why are we doing it at all? And I think, you know, putting that out there, it's something for people to think about. And then if they still want to go ahead with it, well, then they're informed. But, you know, it's sort of, as you're saying, sounds like a lot of the time, maybe we don't need to do that.
It is, and people are still, I wouldn't consider myself anti-embalming at all. I think that I'm pro-choice with people's death decisions, and I don't want embalming to be the thing that people feel forced into or feel like they have to do when
right.
someone dies. And I want them to know that there are lots of other options out there. And if I give them, if I tell them what embalming is and what it entails, and they say, yeah, but I still want mom to look a certain way in the casket, of course, absolutely. There are lots of embalmers who will help you achieve that, and it's absolutely should be your right with the body. But if you now know what embalming is and it doesn't appeal to you as much, I want to hopefully give you the tools to be able to tell the funeral home that's not what you want.
Mm. If you don't embalm a body, how long will the person kind of look similar to when they died? Just a few days?
Sure. There's a couple of different options. Refrigeration is remarkable in that sense. Refrigeration, if you get, and most funeral homes should have some kind of refrigeration. And so if you give a body to a funeral home, if they put it under refrigeration, it should be fine until if you want to come back and then do a viewing 2 days later, 3 days later, 4 days later, that's perfectly fine. The refrigeration slows down decomposition significantly. If you end up keeping the body with you in your home, say somebody died under hospice care and you decide that you really want to have the wake at home the way that I did for my cat or you did for your dog, really the best way is to have some sort of ice packs or dry ice or something underneath the body to keep them cool. Same principle of cooling the body down and not really slowing decomposition. So there are always options, and it usually is with cooling the body down.
Because my experience of seeing people close to me who've been embalmed is that it's sort of freakish in a way, because they really look quite unnatural. You know, they don't look like a dead version of themselves. They look like a sort of waxwork of themselves. And so I've found that personally more disturbing, you know, because it doesn't look like them. So you want that final kind of goodbye, and you're saying goodbye to this sort of, I don't know, waxwork. I mean, is that something that's also different if you just refrigerate the body rather than embalming it?
It is. I certainly think it is. And the look of the embalmed body is not one that I enjoy personally. And I do get that a lot from people. They say, when I suggest to them, why don't you keep the body in the home, or why don't you help take care of the body yourself? They say, I don't really want to, because I had such a bad experience when I saw my uncle and he just kind of looked like a clown, and I could see they had makeup on him, and I could see, and I have to tell them, okay, I understand that was unpleasant for you, but that's not what this would be. That's really different, actually, than what you'd see with a more natural body that has not been embalmed, that doesn't have any makeup on it. It really is a different experience, because the person will look much more dead, but that's what they're supposed to look like. They're
yes.
supposed to die, and they're supposed to look like themselves for a few hours, and then you start to notice little changes, little sinking of the skin. They go to room temperature. They become stiff. Usually rigor mortis sets in. And you can tell that they're gone and that they've left the building and that there's nobody inhabiting that body anymore. But it's not a horrifying thing. It's actually a very, I think, lovely thing to see that. And it helps you transition out of this mode of they're alive. And it doesn't lead to what I think can sometimes be the fantasy of continued life that's perpetuated by embalming.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Well, if you just joined us, I'm talking to my special guest this week, Caitlin Doughty, New York Times bestselling author of Smoke Gets in Your Eyes and Other Lessons from the Crematory. We're going to go to a break now, but we'll be back after these messages.
Ciao, I'm Luca from Tramonti at 528 Seabright Avenue, steps from the ocean. We are the authentic Italian pizza and pasta restaurant, serving also organic salad and house-made dessert in a friendly family-style atmosphere, indoor or on our lovely patio.
Tramonti is open every day from noon to 9 and later on Fridays and Saturdays. Come enjoy our specials every Tuesday neighborhood night and the best deal for a healthy bite at lunch every day.
We bake our bread and prep our fresh pasta and pizza daily. Beppe, Daniel and I want to say grazie to the Santa Cruz community for supporting us in the past 2 years. Allora, buon appetito!
Visit Luca and Beppe at Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue. That's Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue.
Nevada's wild horses are disappearing from our rangelands at an alarming rate. Every day, horses are rounded up, captured, sold, and sent off to be cruelly slaughtered for food overseas. The horses you see out your window today could end up on someone's dinner plate tomorrow. We simply must do something to save them. This great country was built on the backs of the horses. They helped us plow our fields, pull our wagons, and they deserve all the dignity and respect afforded other American icons. The horse helped us craft this nation we know and revere today. This is country music star Lacey J. Dalton. I have dedicated my life to save Nevada's wild horses, but I cannot save them without your help. Your generous donations are the only chance some of these horses have. Visit letemrun.com for more information. Join me. Nevada's wild horses are disappearing from our rangelands at an alarming rate. Visit letemrun.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland. I'm talking with my special guest, Caitlin Doughty, about her best-selling book, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes and Other Lessons from the Crematory, which has just come out recently or is coming out very soon as a paperback. And Caitlin is doing a book tour at the moment, and we're lucky that she's going to be coming to Bookshop Santa Cruz on the 30th of September at 7 p.m. So hopefully you might be able to go along to that. And also, just to let you know, if you want more information about Caitlin and what she does, you can go to the website orderofthegooddeath.com, orderofthegooddeath.com. Well, before the break, we were talking about how having someone at home doing a wake at home and being with the body, with it not being embalmed, can actually be a process of a lovely thing, you were saying. And I was thinking that in a way that if you think of the body as a sort of temple for the spirit, then when the spirit leaves, if that is your belief system, then what is left behind is not sort of like the remains or something that's this horrid, a reminder of death, but sort of the house of something, someone beautiful that you loved. Is that in any way how you approach this, Caitlin?
I think so. Yeah, I think that's a pretty good description of how I see it. I see I've called the dead body a beautiful shell before, because I think that, yes, most people in some way or another believe that there's something that leaves the body, whether it's just the brain shutting down or there's a soul that has some other journey. You believe that the body has been left by something that animates it.
Yeah.
But the body itself is still really valuable, and it's still a reminder of the life the person lived, and it was what carried them around for so many years, and it's the face that you knew and the body that you knew. So I still think that there's a fair amount of value in interacting with it, I guess.
Yes. There seems to be a lot more written about the spirit and the soul around death, I would say, than the significance of the end of the body. Why do you think in the West, particularly in America, we've come to have so little ritual and beliefs around disposal of the body?
Well, because I think, again, that it has a lot to do with the funeral industry, and that it has a lot to do with the relationship that we've created with the funeral industry, which is one where they can basically dictate a lot of the rituals and rites that we have. And what's going on now, I think, is that you have an increasingly secular population. You have a very large immigrant population. And for the most part, the funeral industry hasn't done a very good job at adapting or celebrating those differences. So you have people who aren't really sure what their ritual is, maybe, in the case of someone secular, or somebody who really does know what their ritual is, but just can't find anyone to help them to engage with it. And so you end up with a lot of the population not being really adequately served by the industry.
So you founded this organization, the Order of the Good Death, made up of morticians, academics, and artists. Would you say that one of the primary motivators of that is to provide a place that people can actually explore what their relationship with death is and what they might want their ritual to be?
Yeah, I would say that. And really, the several ideas behind it, but it's a place where people who are real geeks about death, real nerds about death, really passionate about death and the history and the culture surrounding death, can come and feel like they have a place. And for people who are neophytes about death, who don't know much about death at all, can come and see that there are all of these people doing really interesting work around new ways to dispose of the dead body, whether it's composting or water cremation, or any of these new technologies around death and dying, or the history of death, or artistic representations of death. They can see that there are all these people and that there really is a community who want to engage with them. And hopefully they feel like they can ask those questions and that it's a safe place.
Yes, yeah. I'm wondering why you chose to write about this subject as a memoir rather than, say, a fictional story using your experiences or a more informational approach. What appealed to you about memoir?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't read a lot of fiction, to be honest. I read primarily nonfiction. And unfortunately for the work that I do, a lot of academic books, not unfortunately, they're very good. They're just slightly drier for the most part. But mostly nonfiction is what I really enjoy. And so I don't necessarily feel qualified to write anything fictional. And I've never really had that kind of passion for it. And the reason that I think memoir really appealed to me and worked in this case is that I wanted people to go on the journey with me. I wanted them to be with me when I first walked in and I see a dead body and I feel kind of, ooh, hi, dead body, poke, poke. And I wanted them to, if they feel that way about dead bodies, I wanted to let them know, hey, I felt that way too at first. Mm-hmm. And it was an interesting, strange, surreal experience to be there with a dead body. And then how that changes over time and how once you really learn, and that's why I put all the history and the context in there, once you learn about other cultures and once you learn about the history of death in the Western world, you can really start to change how you feel about the dead body and how you feel about death in general. So the idea was hopefully to create or to write about myself and hopefully be a sympathetic enough character that they wanted to go on the journey with me.
Yeah, well, I think that's certainly the result. I mean, really enjoying reading it so far, even though it is a difficult topic, and it does obviously trigger various things inside you, depending on one's own experiences or beliefs or whatever, as you're reading it. So I think it's a lot to process, but at the same time, it's very interesting on a lot of different levels. You have a lot of information that isn't available to people about how the actual industry works, but also the historical information you include, I think, it is very interesting. The death ritual practices, you mentioned the ritual of a tribe in Brazil, which is perhaps one of the most difficult for us to relate to. I wonder if you could tell us a bit about that, and also how you feel we've reached this place where, with so many things, we feel like the way we do things is right, you know, as opposed to how other cultures do things.
Sure, and that's actually something that I'm working on now, writing about as well, is how to really get across to people that the way that we do death is not the way that other places do death. It's not the way that Americans have done death historically, and it's not the way that many other cultures in the world right now do handle death or see death or handle the dead body. Mm. And one example, the one that you were talking about, is the Wari, which is a tribe in Brazil, and it was an indigenous tribe in Brazil, although they don't practice this custom anymore, because what happened is that the Christian missionaries and the Brazilian government came in and said, okay, I know that we've now we've destroyed much of your population with disease, and now we're going to give you medicine and help only if you stop your death rituals, which included cannibalism. Mm. And at first, cannibalism, I think, has a lot of negative connotations for people, and rightly so. But when I actually started reading about this and looking into it, the cannibalism that they practiced was mortuary cannibalism, which meant that they ate their own dead, and they ate basically their in-laws, and it was considered a really, really important thing, and it was considered a good deed, and you were doing an amazing thing for your family because you were making sure that that body was taken in, and that it wasn't in the cold ground, or that it wasn't anywhere the person didn't want to be. You were getting rid of the body, and through that process, you were getting rid of a lot of the grief, and then the community could come together and pick up the grieving family again. Yeah. And you read about it, and you go, wow, okay, that I'm not considering cannibalism for my own family, but that actually seems much more intimate and thought out and engaged than when my grandma died.
Yes.
And it really makes you think about, okay, yeah, that this sounds horrible to my ears, but once you find out what a community is thinking, usually there's some beauty to it and some meaning to it. And there's nobody around the world who just throws away their dead bodies.
No.
That's not what happens. There's always some engagement with death. And for the most part, it's the universal experience of grief, and the forms that those take are different, but it's the universal need to process is going to be there. And how that happens is incredibly fascinating.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And it seems to me that with your book and also the organization, The Order of the Good Death, part of what you're focusing on is highlighting the art of death rather than just the science, that it can be a creative experience as well as a destructive one. Is that some part of how you're thinking about this?
Yes, and the science is really very fascinating. But with the art, I believe that the creative impulse that any of us has comes from death. It comes from the fact that we know that we're going to die. We have a deadline, and the deadline, including death, is that ultimately our lives are going to end. And so that gives us the motivation that we need to create something. If you're an artist, what motivation is there, or you're a writer, what motivation is there to finish a chapter or to finish a painting if you had forever? if we were creatures of immortality? What's the reason to achieve or to finish anything? And the reason that the Mona Lisa was painted is because there was death on the horizon and something had to be done. And so anything artistic and beautiful that we've created, I think, comes from death, and death doesn't get enough credit, I would say, for its relationship to creation.
Right. Yeah. We've got just a couple of minutes left of the show, but I wanted to ask you, what do you hope for us as a society with regard to how we relate to death and treat our dead?
Oh, wow. Well, I have so many hopes. Who knows what will actually come to pass, but I would love a society that's much more open to a more natural way of death, a more family-centered way of death, one that includes green burial and that includes, or natural burial, just the body in the ground, one that includes better processes for disposing of a body, like alkaline hydrolysis or aquamation, as some call it, which is basically similar to cremation, except with water instead of fire to decompose the body.
Oh, wow.
And I think that there are a lot of good technologies that are developing. There's human composting that I've been involved in and an advisor on. And there's so many new things, and it's really, we're experiencing a renaissance, I think, in thought and idea around death and dying and what to do with the dead body and how to handle the dead body. But it can only truly be a successful renaissance if the rest of the public is coming along with us. So you can have all of these people that are doing this incredible work, but if we can't convince the public of its value, and we can't convince the public of why it's important that we're doing this and why they should maybe see death differently and why they should have the conversation, then we're failing, essentially.
Yeah. Well, I think it's very worthwhile what you're doing. So I really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing some of your ideas and parts of the book with us. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
So I've been talking to Caitlin Doty about her book, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes and Other Lessons from the Crematory. It's a really good read. I'm reading it at the moment, and it's very interesting and informing and also very well written. So you can enjoy it on many levels. And I would encourage you to go to Caitlin's appearance at Bookshop Santa Cruz on the 30th of September at 7 p.m. and check out the book a bit more, and you'll get to ask questions. You can have your book signed. So again, that's 30th of September, 7 p.m. at Bookshop Santa Cruz. And the website for Caitlin again is Order of the Good Death, with two D's, with Good Death, orderofthegooddeath.com. And just remind you again about our website, itsaquestionofbalance.com. You can hear podcasts there of all our previous shows. If you really enjoyed this show, you can tell your friends about it, point them to the website. And we've also had some very interesting topics that you can dip into as well via the podcast on the website. So again, that's itsaquestionofbalance.com. I'll see you next week.